You're listening to a podcast from 702 and Cape Talk.
Just gone 8 minutes past 12 o'clock. Good afternoon from me, Ray White, in for Stephen Curtis on the Midday Report. Stephen will be back tomorrow afternoon. Well, coming up on the program in the next hour, that breaking news story in Eyewitness News, ANC MP Makhosi Khoza has been officially charged. Well, the ANC's Provincial Executive Committee in KwaZulu-Natal has served Khoza with a charge sheet relating to ill discipline. They had warned her that they were going to do it. She also apparently received death threats after speaking out. A little bit later on in the program, we'll be catching up with Eyewitness News reporter Zianda Tolo to get the latest on that one. Also coming up this afternoon, the processing of blood samples from hospitals around the country, including those for HIV and cancer, may come to a halt this week. Nationwide strike has been declared by workers. The Ahmed Timol inquiry is continuing, crossing to Barry Bapen to discuss that story. There are growing calls for an early election if President Jacob Zuma loses the vote of no confidence against him next month, and concerns of yet more downgrades. So lots to discuss this afternoon in the show. I'd like to hear from you. You can SMS me on 31702 or 31567 or tweet on @RayWhiteSA. Let's go to our other top story at the moment. Yet another office of a high-ranking official has been broken into, this time at the office of the Chief Public Prosecutor in Pretoria. The break-in, which happened last Thursday, comes just 2 weeks after computers were stolen from the office of the Pretoria Director of Public Prosecutions. Many months ago, the Midrand offices of the Constitutional Court were also broken into. So that's three instances now. Police say they cannot confirm exactly what was taken in the latest incidents, but that an office where dockets are kept is where the incident actually happened. Joining us in our Johannesburg studio is Eyewitness News reporter Gia Nicolaides. Gia, what exactly do we know so far then?
Well, Ray, as you said, last week, Thursday evening, Chief Prosecutor Matrik Lupondo's office in the Pretoria Magistrates Court was broken into. And it's understood that these offices have state-of-the-art CCTV cameras and is considered secure. Police are saying they cannot confirm exactly what was taken during this break-in, but that the office where the dockets are kept is where the incident happened. And it's not clear what cases Lupondo was working on when his office was robbed.
Now, Gia, why only reveal almost a week later that there's been a break-in?
That's right. So this happened last week, Thursday, and it's unclear why we're only hearing about it now. And perhaps this is because insiders spoke to News 24 about the incident. Earlier today, however, Eyewitness News spoke to two Gauteng police spokespeople, with one saying he's not aware of the incident, while the other says it was never reported to any police station in the capital. Then later on, we got confirmation from the police that they are now investigating a case of business robbery. The MPA says it did happen. They're not commenting until the investigation is over. And when I spoke to the Hawks a little bit earlier, they said that they weren't aware of it, that they will look into it, but they haven't been asked to investigate at this particular stage.
Many people already joining the dots. Now, there were arrests for the Constitutional Court officers' break-in many months ago, but no more arrests for the other incidents since?
That's right. So 2 weeks ago, computers were stolen from the office of the National Director of Public Prosecutions, where intruders, if listeners remember, intruders gained access to the building via fire escape and then climbing through the window which leads to the ladies' bathroom. A lot of these robberies have happened in recent months. At the beginning of July, the Hawks had a break-in at their head office in Pretoria. And in March, 15 computers were stolen from the office of the Chief Justice in Midrand. So a lot of questions still need to be asked about why these robberies are happening at these state institutions, how they gained access. And of course, the questions that we'll be asking police is, are these inside jobs that are happening? And who are they giving this information to?
Eyewitness News reporter Gia Nicolaides in our Johannesburg studios.
The Midday Report on 702.
Your number one news and talk station.
The Ahmed Timol inquiry is continuing this afternoon after evidence yesterday that police tried to cover their tracks when he was killed. Timol died in 1971 after falling from the 10th floor of the John Forster Square police station in Johannesburg. The police claimed he committed suicide. His family say he was murdered. Eyewitness News reporter Barry Bateman is covering the story in the Pretoria High Court. Good afternoon, Barry. Take us through then what's happened today.
Good afternoon, Ray. Well, This morning we've had the testimony of forensic pathologist Dr. Shakira Holland, who has provided us information about the types of injuries a person would sustain if they had fallen from a height. She goes into the particular detail, the characteristics of these kind of injuries, the blunt force trauma type injuries that the person would sustain. We were also then led through the original pathologist report of Ahmed Timo, which detailed the extent of his injuries. I mean, to the finest detail, Ray, the smallest bruises. We also walked through the types of injuries that are consistent with a fall. For example, the fractures to the base of his skull. Now, these would call, if somebody was falling from a height, they landed on their feet. It's called a transferal type of injury, where the force of the fall of landing on the hard surface is transferred up through the spine, and it cracks the base of the skull. But then we also learned, Ray, that he had a fractured skull on the top of his head, among other types of bruises and injuries that were sustained. The conclusion of Holland is that there are numerous injuries that Timo sustained which are not consistent with a fall from a height. She has concluded that several of the abrasions and the bruises were sustained prior to his death from falling, which is suggested that he was assaulted by the police while he was held in custody. We've gone into another leg of analysis now, and I'll take you back to referring to that wound on the top, or the fracture on the top of Timo's skull. And what we've learned here is this is a type of wound that could have been caused by a hard, blunt blow to the top of the head. And the fact that it was dented in would have caused damage to the brain. This could have led to unconsciousness. And the question was put to Holland, well, if somebody was unconscious, is it possible that Timo was in fact thrown from the, he was alive at the time he was, before he died, but unconscious. And she said, this is entirely possible. So the possibility here is that Timo was severely assaulted, hit on the head to the point that he was unconscious, then picked up and actually thrown out of the window where he sustained those numerous other injuries and died.
And of course, the courts yesterday are also hearing other evidence of a cover-up.
Well, indeed, and this relates to how the police reacted when they found Timo. What we know from the evidence is that the police officers say Timo had committed suicide. He jumped out the window. They ran down. They had blankets with them. They found a pulse on Timo, picked him up, put him in a blanket, and they took him back up to the 9th floor, Ray. Well, what we hear here is, and it was the surgeon Boffard talking, his experience goes back many years of training paramedics in Gauteng and obviously the Transvaal back then, is that the police, even in 1971, were very reluctant to move a patient because of the fear, even at the time, of being held liable for further injuries to a critically injured patient. So he says he was very surprised that the police would pick up Timo and take him and move him away from the scene. The suggestion here is, Ray, that they specifically moved him because they didn't want to leave an intact crime scene, which could give clues as to what may have led to his death. So essentially, they disturbed the crime scene and destroyed it so to frustrate any further investigation.
Eyewitness News reporter Barry Bateman on the line from the High Court in Pretoria.
702 and Cape Talk.
The Midday Report.
A strike by thousands of employees in the National Health and Laboratory Services looks set to get underway. Talks between management and unions have deadlocked. Part of their core duties, you see, include processing blood samples from hospitals around the country, including those for HIV and cancer. So if you're thinking about getting a blood sample analyzed, there may be a problem. On the line is Nahawu spokesperson Kaya Klaba. Good afternoon, Kaya. Welcome to the show. Now, what exactly is Nahawu seeking?
Well, like you said, the strike started this morning. Basically, our demand is a 7.3% wage increase. And then there's other issues like the issue of housing. We want a housing allowance of 2,000, the issue of outsourcing, rural allowance, and danger allowance. Of course, linked to the issue of the maladministration that is happening here, the corruption, and also the issue that we want the NHLS to report back to the public service so that these workers can enjoy those benefits that are enjoyed by public service workers. So we've deadlocked with the employer, and we've been trying to find common ground, and we are not. That's why we took this last resort of going on a strike.
Kaya, just speaking about that 7.3% salary increase, has there been any sort of agreement on that? I know that there are other outstanding issues.
Well, the 7.3, we actually did agree on that they'll give us the 7.3. But over the years, one of our problems is that we found that the NHLS seems to be very unreliable, because the issues that we're fighting for this time are issues that we agreed on in the 2015-2016 strike. So whatever we agree on, we're not sure really that they'll implement it. So we'd want a concrete commitment that will say that whatever we agreed on, they'll implement. Of course, they've agreed to the 7.3%. Of course, then the other issues, like the issue of insourcing. They want insourcing to start on the 1st of April 2018, while we want...
All right, Kai, sorry, just move around a little bit. I'm losing you a little bit with the cell phone signal.
Still?
There we go. Right, pick it up from there. Yeah, pick it up from there, yeah.
Yes, I'm saying they want insourcing to happen as from the 1st of April 2018, while we want it to happen sooner, on the 1st of September 2017. So those are some of the things where we're not finding each other. But we're open to negotiations. Whenever they are ready to negotiate with us, we'll be ready to listen to them and actually take it back to workers. So the ball is in their court. We're ready to strike indefinitely.
Just hearing what you're saying, what has management then said about further talks?
Sorry to repeat that.
What has management said about further talks? Do you have any further talks or talks planned?
Well, as far as I know, there's a two-day board meeting which started this morning, which ends tomorrow. Hopefully, the issue of the strike will be discussed in the board meeting, and they'll come back to us with a revised offer, which will be able to entertain and see if workers will be able to accept it.
Is there no other way to avoid a strike? We're talking about cancer patients and others also being affected. They need their blood results to be analyzed. Is there any way to avoid this?
Well, it's not an ideal situation for us as well. Like I said, the strike is the last option that we have in order to twist the arm of the employer. We've tried everything. We've been to the CCMA. We've had countless meetings where we're trying to find common ground, but we've failed. And the strike is the last option for us to try and twist the arm of the employer. And hopefully they'll realize that we're not playing games. We really, really want things to change. We really want a living wage for our workers. We really want a good working condition for our workers. So it's really up to them, and it's their prerogative to ensure that they put contingency measures in place so that they don't feel the full effect of the strike. So everything is up to them. We're willing to negotiate. We're willing to go back to work as soon as they give us what we want.
Our spokesperson, Kaya Klaba, on the line from Johannesburg. Thanks for your time on the Midday Report.
SMS us on 31702 or 31567.
Some of your SMSs and your tweets. One tweet on Atre White SA is from King Sabu. He says, Atre White SA, how easy is it to break into these official offices these days? Can anyone just waltz in, or most likely it's an inside job? And I think that's a very good point. You got a very, very good point there. How is it that this has happened, that once again an official office has been broken into? And it's a major indictment on the judiciary and also the NPA. And then quite a few people actually also reacting about our breaking news story in Eyewitness News. As goes, ANC MP Makhosi Khoza has been officially charged. The ANC's Provincial Executive Committee in KwaZulu-Natal has served Khoza with a charge sheet relating to ill discipline. You'd know this. Last week, the party announced it would bring charges against Khoza for her public statements calling for President Jacob Zuma to step down. I'd like to hear from you. You can SMS me on 31702 or 31567. Has the ANC gone one step too far, or is this a case, a simple case of the ANC saying, right, you are speaking out against our leader, and you simply can't do that?
The Midday Report on your number one news and talk station.
Gauteng Education MEC Panyaza Lesufi is meeting with parents and teachers of Eclipsebreit West Secondary School in Soweto later on today, following protests over the recent appointments of a black school principal. The school was closed on Monday as residents were angry, allegedly because the new headmaster is black. They claim the process of appointing the new principal was flawed. Well, MEC Panyaza Lesufi has condemned the disruption of schooling there and says those responsible will be called to account. Many questions about this. On the line is Masana Ndinga Kanga of the Center for the Study of Violence and Reconciliation, a researcher there. Masana, good afternoon. Welcome to the Midday Report. Race playing a role in protest. This is very concerning, isn't it?
Yeah, indeed. I mean, I sort of get the sense that South Africa's experience with race identity and politics has been escalated and increasing over the past few months.
Just hearing you say that, why are sections of the community still so polarized? You would think since 1994, it's been, what, quite a long time, put it that way. My math isn't very good at the moment. Quite a long time. Why are we still so polarized?
Yeah, I mean, 23 years on, I think these comments have been made a number of times, where the geospatial nature of apartheid means that you can have things called colored communities, black communities, and then, you know, sort of the areas that are seemingly diversifying, such as suburbs. But, you know, really the nature of how housing, race, employment, mobility, how these all interact is very much along the geospatial lines of apartheid. And that's increasingly problematic for addressing the so-called reconciliation agenda.
But these are two communities living very close to one another. You would think after all this time, things would have merged.
Yeah, I mean, in some ways, yes, and in some ways, no. I mean, so integration, like communities, tend to stay with one another. And this is not just sort of a coincidence or a matter of, like, personal preference. Some of these things are systemic, where people perceive certain neighborhoods which are identified with certain race groups to have certain benefits. And there is, in South Africa, a hierarchy of race identities that are tied to certain areas, right? So, you know, typically people would assume that black schools in townships would be worse off than colored schools, would be worse off than former Model C schools or white schools. And this is a function of how apartheid systemically organized society. You know, it's reinforcing that hierarchy in the lived reality of people since 1994, 23 years on. And those things don't just change with sort of economic rights and political rights and voting rights. People perceive themselves in certain ways, internalized racial identities that can be destructive and problematic.
So then how do you think the Housing Education Department should handle this? Should they go in there guns blazing and say, right, this is what's going to happen, handle it, or should there be more care taken?
You know, I sort of have within myself an internal conflict, right, having also gone to a Model C school. On the one hand, you know, we need to recognize that structurally our schools are inherently divided, that the content and the quality of our education is divided in ways that are inherently racialized. So you can sort of predict the quality of education you're going to get based on the area you come from and the racial identity that where that is. So, you know, you sort of need like a consistent structural reevaluation, not just of the curriculum, but of the capacity and the facilities within schools, right? You need sort of parents and students to be educated, not just on sort of superficial apartheid history, but even on sort of like theories, race theory, class theory, labor theory, and the geospatial nature of apartheid. People need to be learning sociology and not just accounting and biology, for example.
Maybe learning about them. Maybe learning about each other as well. Do you think this is maybe just the growing pains that have come since the legacy of apartheid? We're still going through those growing pains.
I think so, yes. And I also think that there's sort of, you know, reconciliation as a concept only works when there are clear, visible deliverables that people can hold on to. You know, so I mean, reconciliation in and of itself isn't enough where people are facing relative deprivation. And I'm not talking about poverty, I'm talking about inequality.
So where there are high levels of inequality, you will find that people perceive themselves in ways that are contrary to this reconciliation agenda. And until equality is on the agenda in ways that are meaningful, like social and economic inequality, until those are addressed and the racial nature of those are addressed, really, you know, I think the growing pains have sort of the tendency to become chronic illness, if that makes sense,
yeah.
You know.
Indeed it does. Masana Ndinga Kanga of the Center for the Study of Violence and Reconciliation. Thanks for your time on the Midday Report.
The Midday Report. Business.
And this EWN Business is brought to you by FNB. It's more than just business to you. That's why they help. AECI has released their results. Revenue for the interim period decreased by 7% to 8.478 billion rand. However, profit from operations jumped the other way, 19% to 677 million rand. The group says its pillar strategy will be leveraged to expand its geographic footprint through organic growth and also acquisitions. In other news, and this is very interesting, Britain says it will ban the sale of certain new petrol and diesel-powered cars from 2040 as part of a plan to get them off the roads altogether 10 years later. This follows a similar announcement earlier on this month by the French government, while German cities, including Stuttgart and Munich, have also said they're considering banning some diesel vehicles. The British government has been under pressure to take steps to reduce air pollution after losing legal cases brought by campaigning groups and in May set out proposals for a scrappage scheme to get rid of the most polluting vehicles. Ahead of a June election, the governing Conservatives pledged to make almost every car and van zero emission by 2050. I wonder if that's going to happen in this country. Looking at the markets, a short while ago, the All Share was up around 0.4% at 54,710 points. The rest of the major indicators also in positive territory. Amplats up over 2%. Bidvest looking good, up over 1.5%. And then looking at the local currency, the Rand is around 13.04 to the dollar, 16.99 to the pound, 15.16 to the euro. Gold, $1,245.90, and then Brent crude oil is $50.49. More business news with Bruce on the Money Show this evening. Well, the Public Investment Corporation has warned the chances of further credit rating downgrades remain high. The PIC statement formed part of Finance Minister Molusi Gigaba's response to a parliamentary question posed by the Democratic Alliance. The opposition party inquired about the effects this year's downgrades have had on the government's employees' pension fund. That's the thing. If there's a downgrade, it does have a huge effect on people, specifically those who have invested their money, i.e. our government employees. On the line is Nedbank economist Isaac Machejo. Good afternoon, Isaac. Welcome to the show. Now, concerns that more downgrades may be on the way. What are your thoughts?
Good afternoon, Ray. You know, let's just go back to that first week of April when we saw the downgrades. What has happened since then? Looking at the growth numbers, for instance, we have confirmation that the economy has dipped into recession now. So we've had two consecutive quarters of negative growth. And since then, the numbers that we've seen are pointing towards the economy remaining weak. The other thing which has happened, you know, which was sort of highlighted by the rating agencies, was contingent liabilities. Remember that at the end of June, the government had to draw 2 billion, just over 2 billion, out of the revenue fund to settle a debt of South African Airways. And when it comes to policy uncertainty, unfortunately, things have gotten worse. Let's just focus on the revised mining charter. You know, we got the mining charter, and there's hostilities, you know, between the DME and the chamber. And of course, you know, when Minister Molusi Gigaba presented his action plan, he stated that, you know, the mining charter would be negotiated, but clearly it seems that the mining minister has got no intention to do that. So unfortunately, things haven't gotten any better since the last round of downgrades. So most likely, we are going to be downgraded again. It's all going to be about what's in the mini budget in the third week of October, and also the budget statement in February next year.
You know, just hearing you saying that, Isaac, with the minerals minister digging in his heels on the mining charter, is this maybe not damaging investment and also business confidence? Listening to the Kalani Gwana show this morning, you can only help but think if anybody else overseas is listening to this interview, they were talking to the deputy minister, we're in trouble.
Absolutely. You know, there's a lot of policy confusion at the moment. I mean, that interview confirmed that, you know, there's no proper cooperation or coordination of cabinet activities. You know, policy is all over the place. And unfortunately, as you allude to, that has hurt business investment. I mean, just look at business confidence. It's at its lowest levels in almost 20 years. And because of that, we've seen fixed investment spending by the private sector contracting since the second half of 2015.
What can a further downgrade do to the local economy? I spoke about the PIC in my intro, but there's also SASSA grants and other things as well, aren't there?
You know, our big concern is the local currency rating. You know, two out of the three rating agencies still have us on investment grade. If they downgrade us to junk status on the local currency, that will just spell bad news for our economy. The cost of credit will be higher. I mean, at the very start, we'll see money flowing out of South Africa as international investors who hold South African assets, that is rand-denominated assets, are going to sell down. That will put the rand under pressure, and that could stoke inflation, and we could see the interest rate cuts, for instance. If we're going to see any more, which we expect, we could see those being halted. And actually, if inflation really goes out of control, we could see the Reserve Bank starting to hike again.
This is certainly concerning, because all those who, obviously the pensioners don't like that, but all those with bonds and other money borrowers would like to see those interest rates go the other way. Nedbank economist Isaac Machego, thanks for your time this afternoon on the Midday Report.
702 and Cape Talk.
The Midday Report.
There are growing calls for an early election if President Jacob Zuma loses the vote of no confidence against him in a couple of days' time, or next month. Speaker Baleka Mbete still needs to decide on a secret ballot after the Constitutional Court instructed her that the decision lies actually with her. On the line is DA leader Musi Maimane. Good afternoon, Musi. Welcome to the show.
Good afternoon, Ray, and good afternoon to the listeners.
Firstly, any indication on when there will be a decision on a secret ballot?
Well, I think what Baleka Mbete is doing is playing for time and making sure that she doesn't give parties who've already said that they would take the matter to court anyways a lot of time. But the reality behind it is that whether it's by secret ballot or open ballot, the fact of the matter is that Jacob Zuma is unfit to lead South Africa.
Well, see, if a vote of no confidence is successful, it is successful in Parliament, what would the DA like to see happen next?
Look, we would have to set up an interim government that would make sure South Africa could get to the polls soon. Because the fundamental issue is the fact that the ANC's own deep divisions aren't going to be able to guide South Africa out of a recession, aren't going to help those young South Africans who are unemployed. And therefore, the sooner South Africans can elect a government that could formulate a plan, give policy certainty, so we ensure, in fact, that South Africa can get itself out of a recession, the better. And so we would like to see that without having to resolve the ANC's political problems on the floor of Parliament, rather that the electorate have a voice.
Talking about apparent divisions within the ruling party, Makosi Khoza now facing charges. Your reaction?
The ANC is deeply divided, and the ANC is in fact dead as a brand. What has become quite clear is that consciousness is something that becomes penalized. When somebody stands up and says, we want to play South Africa first, the ANC says that can't be good enough, and that's what she's been persecuted for. And I would hope that more members of the ANC would find their voice, that they would come out and vote, and ultimately that we put South Africa and South Africans above everything else that we do. And so it's become quite clear to me that it's gone further than just the contestation for Zuma. It's in fact the fact that the organization as a collective is being caught up in a patronage network that can't resolve the very facing crisis of South Africa. Mm-hmm.
Going back to that vote of no confidence, do you have any numbers regarding support for the motion?
Look, there are various MPs have already indicated support and have been coming out more vocally saying they would be open to voting. And at this point in time, I can't give definitive numbers, but we're working and we'll continue to lobby because we believe that South Africa, for it to survive, it needs a new change.
And then just a final question. Legally speaking, the DA is saying there may be a new legal way to go regarding the president. There haven't been more details about that. Can you give us more details?
As you know, on the first instance, I mean, we've already said that the charges that Jacob Zuma faces, the 700-plus charges, stand. And we believe that the Supreme Court of Appeal will hear that argument and dismiss Jacob Zuma's frivolous application to try and delay this matter even further. And so those charges must stand because Zuma must face absolute prosecution. And if you're a president and facing criminal charges, that becomes, and what we must begin to do is ask the question whether he himself should not be personally liable for all of these costs that he keeps using in the state and obfuscating the case. So on that one particular case, we will continue to pursue it, and we're looking at other options as to how we can ensure that ultimately Jacob Zuma ends up having his day in court, and if needs be, ends up in jail, because it is right that anybody who defrauds the people of South Africa of their resources must face the full might of the law. If anybody is wanting to offer amnesty deals and all sorts of further corruption, cannot be allowed to do that, because ultimately you can't tell citizens that just because you are politically connected or you are in fact the president, that amnesty can be offered to you through cash payments that will in fact absolve you from criminal charges. Can't be, and will continue to pursue that case against Jacob Zuma.
Yeah. DA Federal Leader Musi Maimane, thanks for your time this afternoon on the Midday Report.
The Midday Report on your number one news and talk station.
Coming up to 12 minutes to 1 o'clock, and a South African-born child only has trace amounts of the HIV virus, despite not being on antiretrovirals for 9 years. This was announced at the International AIDS Society Conference in Paris this week. It's a major breakthrough, it's major news, as the world still battles to stop HIV and AIDS. Earlier on, I spoke to Professor Mark Cotton of Stellenbosch University, and I asked him if this was a huge step in the fight against AIDS and HIV.
Correct. It's a big step. You know, it involves only one child, but the principle is important. It's wonderful for the child. We're hoping to learn information that could be applicable to other people who have HIV in the future, although there's a very long road ahead for that at this stage.
What do we know so far about this child managing to stop the virus from replicating? What do we know so far?
Well, what we know firstly is that we have unquestionable evidence that the child does have the presence of HIV that is hiding away in the cell. So the virus is there at a low level, but it is not replicating and is not in the bloodstream. And we, you know, normally we measure something called a viral load to check, you know, firstly, how sick the patient has the potential to be and whether the medication is working. So in patients that are on antiretrovirals, that's working well, the viral load is often undetectable. In this child, it's undetectable. What has been undetectable for more than 8 years without antiretrovirals, which we think is really good.
If you go through history and you look at chickenpox and how that was cured and even prevented, is this another step in curing HIV, or is it just early days?
Well, it's another step, but it's a small step along the pathway to cure. The what is interesting is that there actually is a very active cure agenda in HIV. This all started with the description of the Berlin patient. This is an adult patient who received two bone marrow transplants in Berlin, actually an American citizen who we think has actually been cured of HIV. So this one person has established a research agenda. The next follow-up was the Mississippi child, which was also, that was a child that was reported in 2013. And at that stage, it was a young infant that received full antiretroviral therapy at 31 hours of age and was treated for around about 18 months. And the mother actually stopped treatment. And when the child was retested, also had a negative viral load and managed to remain off antiretrovirals without a virus in the blood for almost 2 years, but then relapsed and the virus came back. So, and then in adults, there's a very famous and well-characterized cohort in based in Paris, France, the Visconti cohort, where a number of adults, approximately 10, were detected when they acutely acquired HIV and they were put onto antiretrovirals for 4 to 5 years, and about 6 to 7 years after stopping antiretrovirals are still essentially virus-free in the blood. So this is a the beginnings of a trajectory, and there's a lot of work to do to characterize and understand these few individuals.
Tell me something, is the virus mutating in any way? In other words, is it fighting back?
The virus often does, and that's an excellent question. We do not think so in this particular case. We think that we have a combination of early antiretroviral treatment, but we think it's a combination of early treatment plus a good genetic environment for this child.
HIV, I think the bottom line, HIV is no longer a death sentence, is it?
It is not a death sentence as long as programs are well funded. Then it's fine. It's pretty good. There's still some horrible things happening, but if everything is working the way it should, and in South Africa, to a large extent, that is so, that is the case, it is nothing to be feared. It's something to be managed.
Professor Mark Cotton of Stellenbosch University, thanks for joining us this afternoon on the Midday Report.
Thank you very much. It's a lovely talking to you.
It's a volatile time in U.S. politics. Yesterday, we spoke about a new campaign by the Democrats to garner support. Now, Republican Senator John McCain has called for more bipartisan politics. He's called for more debate instead of a single party just winning. Very interesting. On the line is U.S. foreign policy expert Brooks Spector. Good afternoon, Brooks. Welcome back to the show. Your thoughts, is this a way to navigate maybe around President Donald Trump?
Well, good afternoon. It's good to be with you. John McCain is an extraordinary figure. I mean, he's a war hero. He was a prisoner of war for 5 years during the Vietnam War. He's been a congressman and a senator for many years, child of a military family, and he has an unparalleled respect within the Senate, which he has devoted enormous amounts of energy to. Curiously, he rose up from his hospital bed to come in and cast a vote to allow debate on the Senate floor of the repeal and replace provisions of Obamacare the Republicans are pushing, with the same disease, brain cancer, that Ted Kennedy had famously suffered from when he came into the Senate to push for the original Obamacare 7 years ago. But McCain has never been a hard-edged partisan. He's always been something of a, dare I say it, maverick, something of a let's see if we can't get something done, hard-charging in that way. He's asked for bipartisanship. He's asked for a reach across the aisles. But the temper of the times in the Senate, and especially in the White House, doesn't appear to be in his favor in that regard. But still, you know, the Senate gives a lot of credit to people who've labored there for years and who have an outsized influence on their proceedings. So, you know, it is just possible that by virtue of his elder statesmanship, he can affect something of a modest shift.
But just hearing you say that, does Trump actually enjoy the overall support of his own party?
No, he doesn't enjoy the support. They're restive, they're awkward, they're unhappy. And as I heard someone on one of the newscasts from the U.S. explain yesterday, the congressmen and senators are no longer afraid of him, partly because he's demonstrated that with a very weak popular support, 36% or thereabouts, which you don't really have an effect with, and partly because his attention span to legislative matters has been so peripatetic, he's no longer a force to be feared in the Senate or in the House of Representatives. That does give a little working space if the two parties can find their way to some sort of agreement on some of the issues.
U.S. foreign policy expert Brooke Spector on the line from Johannesburg.
702 and Cape Talk.
The Midday Report.
Now, wrapping up the Midday Report, we were going to speak about Smurfs. I kid you not, the show is on the go at Empress Palace at the moment. We're just way out of time. I have seen the show, though. Went and took the kids to go and see the Smurfs at Empress Palace. I think it runs till the end of this week. Do yourself a favor. Go down and see the Smurfs with the kids. Lots of fun. Then some of your SMSs. One says, Ray, this is a different case. We're talking about Makosi Khoza. This is a different case. She's not simply voting against her leader, but she's voting against someone who's ruining the country. She's a brave woman. That's from Lindy. Then on Atre White Essay, Zaki Matabula, he says, Atre White Essay, ANC KZN is charging someone who believes in democratic South Africa and leaves the people who believe and does not believe in people who believe in looting. Then another one says, more power to Dr. Khoza. Absolutely ridiculous. She gets charged for speaking the truth. Khoza for president, I say. And that one is from Rita. It's 1 o'clock.